This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, left political activists explore ways to challenge the dominance of the two big business parties, the U.S. schemes to manipulate young people in the Congo, and Cuban officials promise that their country will never turn its back on Assata Shakur.
But first, a new report shows that it is rapidly becoming a crime to be poor in the United States. Karen Dolan is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington and the lead author of a report entitled The Poor Get Prison, The Alarming Spread of the Criminalization of Poverty.
Since the recession, state and local and municipal budgets are trying to recoup their deficits in the easiest way possible, and poor people are an easy target. They are more vulnerable than the rest of the population. They have less legal representation. So they seem indeed to be targeted as sources of money, which is a unsound fiscal policy on the face of it that would be clear to anybody that if you're trying to make money on the backs of people who don't have any, that is not a sustainable practice, but there are ways in which it's politically popular, and there is sort of some smoke and mirrors with budgets, and they're an easy target.
When we're talking about targeting poor people with fines and fees for misdemeanor offenses and the growth of what can only be described as debtors' prisons, it looks very much like there's racial animus involved and deeply involved in this.
Yes, the intersectionality is undeniable. There's ways in which the poor writ large, regardless of race, are unquestionably targets and are unquestionably impacted by the increase in aggressive policing, in fines, in fees, in this skipping over of an ability to pay hearing and sending people arrest warrants or even incarcerating them even when they can't pay. But there's also no question that Black poor people are within the demographic of poor people are themselves even further discriminated against, acted against, even more aggressively policed against. And there is much more violence when a Black poor person comes into contact with the police than if a white poor person comes in contact with the police. And also, it is harder for Latinos and immigrants as well. But Black poor people are more adversely affected than other groups.
Could you describe some of these new and not so new practices that have the effect of criminalizing the poor?
We've heard for decades about the welfare queen. So we're sort of familiar with the way in which poor people have been demonized as lazy, as collecting off the public dole and not working and staying home eating bonbons. So we saw in the 80s, especially with President Reagan, demonizing poor single mothers, especially the idea of the welfare queen was a caricature of a poor Black woman. So we're a little bit familiar with the ways in which Black people and poor people have traditionally been viewed as poor, lazy, violent criminals. But something that's new, really, since 2010 and since the financial collapse, is just the expansion of the fines and then fees being tagged on top and court costs and the mandate that we saw so starkly in Ferguson, Missouri, we saw with the Department of Justice investigation shined a big spotlight on this, that the police department and the municipal courts were in the service of collecting money to shore up shrunken budgets. And that's not just happening in Ferguson. It's happening in high poverty, low income areas all over the country. In 2014, NPR did an investigation and found that in 48 states across the country since 2010, there has been an increase in these fines and fees for these misdemeanor, low-level offenses, anything from catching a fish out of season to shoplifting a can of beer to turning right without a right turn signal to a broken taillight, as we saw with Walter Scott, tragically, in South Carolina. So we have seen an increase in this, and I think this is the piece of the puzzle that a lot of people aren't aware of. This has even made that tinderbox more flammable than we have seen in the past. And when it's laid on top of the decades of oppression and of systematic targeting, profiling, and violence, when we've seen this increase sort of under the radar because it's for low-level offenses, violent crime has been going down. Even incarceration rates have been going down. But this kind of aggressive policing for everyday low-level activity that most of us, you know, we get a fine for $50, we pay it, or it's a broken taillight, we have to get a new one. It may be a $250 bill at the end of the day. But if you're poor and you don't have the means to do that, you can't get that, either get that paid or get that fixed within the amount of time that's allotted to you, and there's more aggressive consequences for that now.
And with the decreases in federal aid to the states and therefore state aid to the cities, we could see an increase in the tendency to do like Ferguson does.
Precisely. That's really one of the major drivers behind this really aggressive push to collect these monies. The cops have their pad of ticket papers, and they have a mandate to go out and write all of those tickets and bring in that money. And the same in the courts. And thank goodness that the Department of Justice went in and investigated in Ferguson, because it sort of blew that wide open. And they called them out for violation of 14th Amendment rights, for violation of citizens' rights to due process. So that's happening in city after city. And that's how this idea, this debtors' prisons that have been illegal in this country for 200 years, are making a resurgence. Because in the court system, the courts are under the same push, the same mandate to bring in fees, to bring in fines, to get the money in. And they're acting as aggressively in the courts as they are out on the streets, except they're not armed. But their ammunition is to throw somebody in jail. So they're skipping over the ability to pay hearings, or they're making summary judgments based on how someone is dressed, rather than following the law and determining whether or not somebody has the ability to pay. And if they don't, they cannot be thrown in jail.
And especially in the South, these mechanisms are rapidly being privatized.
Exactly. And so then you also, poor people are vulnerable again. Whenever they get into a court system and they don't have the legal representation that somebody else, first of all, somebody else who has the resources won't end up in court. But if you don't have the resources, you do end up in court. You are, in some instances, not for child support, which is another issue that Walter Scott and many, especially black men, have to face. But in other misdemeanor charges, you can have a public defender, but more and more, you need to apply for a public defender. So now you have to write an application fee, which costs $50. What if you don't have that $50 to apply for the public defender? And the public defender's offices are overwhelmed. So we're like on a factory belt in some places. You know, God bless the public defenders. They're working very, very hard. But in many cases, they are just too overwhelmed to do the kind of work and the kind of justice that a well-paid lawyer would do for a client. So people are very vulnerable. And then they may end up in front of a judge for debt without a lawyer. They don't know that it's unconstitutional to throw them in jail for debt. And they're offered the choice of probation. Well, look, we're not going to throw you in jail for this debt. We're going to assign you to this probation officer over at this private probation company. And they take that. You know, I don't have to go to jail. Thank God I can go to probation. Well, now you're in the hands of a private probation company who slaps a surveillance GPS on your ankle, charges you, I don't know how much that is, a couple hundred bucks for the surveillance. You have your fee. You must pay for your own supervision and surveillance to these private companies. And those fees are enormous. And then you end up in even more debt, and you eventually end up back in jail. It is a vicious cycle that seems almost impossible to get out of.
And taken together, you write that these trends are eliminating people's chances of getting out of poverty. That is, solidifying, locking in poverty as structurally in the United States.
That's right. And that's what we see, you know, behind the scenes of these eruptions of this horrific violence. As you know, that kind of violence has been happening against Black people since this country was started. We're seeing more of it now because of social media and because of smartphones that can videotape this. But what those videos don't necessarily show us is what is happening underneath. Why Walter Scott was pulled over? Why, when the police confronted him, he ran? Because he had been in jail for child support debt. He had paid thousands. He had even turned himself in and willingly went to jail in the past. But the charges are so high. The way we enforce child support in this country is aimed at middle-class fathers who are hiding assets. It isn't appropriate for low-income, non-custodial parents who don't have the ability to pay. And when you live almost from cradle to grave under this fear and anxiety and debt and policing and aggressive violence, of course you're going to run.
Michelle Alexander would probably say that this fits in with the whole new Jim Crow, or what we at Black Agenda Report call the mass black incarceration regime.
Yes, very much so. And that kind of analysis really needs to have more attention. So when we're looking at all of this police violence, I hope that the media and the pundits and the activists on the ground and all of the ways in which we try to understand these horrific pictures that we're seeing on the news, that we really get underneath it to the systemic problems, including, if you step way back, including the increase in income inequality in this country, because really what's at the root of this is the lack of resources. Now, even Black middle class and wealthier Black people are the victims of racial profiling. So even having resources or having some wealth isn't going to protect one from systematic racism, but it protects them a lot more than if they had no resources at all. So there has to be parallel tracks to dismantling systemic racism, changing cultural biases, and we also need to have policies that close that gaping gap between the very wealthy and the poor.
Yes, it seems that this subject of the criminalization of the poor lies strategically between the struggle for economic equality and the struggle against police abuse.
Yes, I think that's right. And I do hope that that gets some attention, that people understand this, and that it is also a very direct result from a fundamentally unequal economic structure in this country.
That was Karen Dolan of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington.
Activists from across the nation gathered in Chicago for a conference on the future of left and independent politics. One of those on hand was Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon, who's also co-chair of the Georgia Green Party. Dixon is a former Black Panther from Chicago who later spent decades helping candidates win local elections.
Most of these things I did in Democratic primary elections. If you had asked me all that time, was I a Democrat, I'd have told you, hell no. Democrat? Me? Come on, no. I kind of know better now. You know, I know that I was what you call a Democrat in denial. Okay? That's what I was. Which kind of brings me to Bernie Sanders. Okay? We've seen the Bernie Sanders. Now, Bernie is not a Democrat in denial. Okay, Bernie is what he is. Like I said, we've seen the Bernie Sanders show before. We know how it ends. Okay? Yeah. Bernie is going to fold his tent. Bernie hasn't got a ghost of a chance of winning the Democratic nomination. He will fold his tent. He will endorse Hillary. And every dollar you put behind Bernie, every nickel and every minute of organizing time and volunteer time that you put behind Bernie, just like all those people that I helped mobilize and that I helped turn out and that I trained and supervised, most of them went and their work benefited Democratic candidates in November. Whatever you do for Bernie is either going to benefit Hillary directly or it's going to vanish into a puff of air the minute he folds his tent. Yep. And there will be nothing left but Hillary.
Right.
You know, what we call people like that, he's not uniquely evil. I don't even know the man. But he's fulfilling a time-honored role that we call the left sheepdog. Y'all know what a sheepdog does? A sheepdog herds people back into the fold. And there's always going to be people who are dissatisfied with what the Democratic Party has to offer, and they're going to start straying to the left. And so it's the job of, well, if this is 2008, it would be the job of Dennis Kucinich. If this was 1992 or 96, it would be the job of Al Sharpton. If it was 84 or 88, it would be the job of Jesse. And this year, it's the job of Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the designated left sheepdog. And I heard Jill say he raised how much recently?
$1.5 million
in a day or 2 days. Okay, so we've got a challenge here. We've got to raise some real money. We've got to raise some real money. And before we even worry a lot about, you know, the candidates, we've got to get nationwide ballot access. Now, I live in Georgia. And in Georgia, if you're going to run for, I live in Newt Gingrich's old district. How about that? If you want to run for Congress in my district, you need about 23,000 and change signatures on a petition. 23,000. If you're going to run in statewide in Georgia, you need 64,000 signatures.
Wow.
If you're going to run in North Carolina, you need 92,000. Indiana, 26,000. It's an insurmountable number. In Georgia, nobody's qualified for the ballot outside the Republican and Democratic parties since the 1940s when the law was passed. So now, if we don't get nationwide ballot access, then somebody running, somebody who lives in Tennessee or Georgia or Michigan or Indiana who wants to run for school board or state rep or Congress as a Green or whatever, then they're going to have nothing to build on. They're going to have to be starting from scratch as far as recognition goes, as far as networks go. We don't need that to happen. I think the most important thing for us to do is to mount a nationwide ballot access campaign this year. When Rosa ran, you were on the ballot in how many states? 31, 32? And how many were you on the ballot in? 39. But many of those states, they were on the ballot as independents.
Yeah, or write-ins.
Okay, and that doesn't leave the kind of mark. We need a mark so that we have actual ballot access, so that if I'm running for school board, county commissioner, I've got a ballot line to qualify for. So, you know, like I said, I'm your numbers guy, and that's where my head is, and we've got a job ahead of us. And like I said, and beware the sheepdog. We've also got to put it out, too. Like I said, that every dollar you put out for Bernie and every hour of volunteer time is an hour of volunteer time that will not be available to get us on the ballot.
Right.
And keep us with a ballot line in every state.
That was Bruce Dixon of the Georgia Green Party at the Chicago Conference on the Future of Left and Independent Politics.
Alice Walker is an activist from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who ran for county sheriff as a socialist. She wound up getting 67,000 votes against the pistol-packing incumbent.
I don't know how many of you follow politics in Milwaukee. Sheriff David Clark is a very special snowflake. He runs as a Democrat. He's certainly not one. He just received, not too long ago, the Charlton Heston Courage Under Fire Award. He's a special man. So basically, we ended up, I was on the November ballot, and in a self-fulfilling prophecy that I actually wasn't expecting, our campaign slogan was draft Bernie Sanders for president. Well, hey, you're welcome. So that worked out. We ended up pulling, as a socialist with absolutely no money, no money, 67,300 and what?
Wow.
92 votes. Please know that I don't kid myself that people voted specifically for me. They voted because that other person wasn't David Clark, because he's so disliked. But I ran on a platform that echoes what everything that Tim said. I mean, we ran on calling a moratorium because the sheriff's purview, part of the sheriff's purview is foreclosures. So echoing what Sherry Honkola did in Philadelphia running for sheriff, calling a moratorium on foreclosures was part of our platform. Also, a living wage, the legalization and decriminalization of marijuana for its impact on mass incarceration, keeping public assets public. Yeah, living wage for sure.
Immigration
reform, absolutely. That we would not be working with ICE to racially profile and brown people up. There's an ordinance on the Milwaukee County that was passed by the Milwaukee County Board in 2012 that allows the sheriff's office not to cooperate with ICE. So we were looking forward to invoking that. And with all of the Black Lives Matter stuff that we've been involved in, had I been elected sheriff, no one would ever have been arrested. I'd like to remind them of that. I tried. But yeah, so basically we ran the grassiest of grassroots campaigns. It was like, look, we ran these off at Kinko's. Take this hot pink flyer. One of the things I think that I really appreciated and a lot of other people appreciated about the campaign was that I centered race, gender, and class. And I'm not going to back away from talking about race, gender, and class just because they may not be popular in some circles. I felt then and I feel now that if you are not centering race and being intersectional about what's happening as far as race, gender, and class and the way these things impact people in what's happening across the country, you're not being genuine about change. And we need to stop dancing around it and treating it like the elephant in the room, call it what it is, and then deal with it. And that's where we are. So, and we did that with the campaign. More people than I ever expected in my life were receptive to that. My buttons were the dopest campaign buttons you have ever seen. They were hot pink and black and had like a cameo of a chick with an afro on. It was dope. I was real proud of that. My mom likes them. My grandkids like them. But yeah, and it's my hope that one of the things that will come out, and I was approached about this as recently as last night, that young people, particularly young women of color, that are thinking about throwing their hat in the ring will look at the campaign and say, you know what, why not? Why not?
Yeah.
Challenge the system. Open the door. Even if you're not going to win, run and prove a point. Because you can, because you're supposed to, because these things that we're fighting for just make sense.
Yes.
Thank you.
Alice Walker, speaking in Chicago.
On Monday, May 12th, the school board in Orange, New Jersey, is scheduled to decide if it will fire a young teacher for helping her third grade students send get well cards to political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is seriously ill. Marilyn Zuniga explains how her troubles started.
It began in the month of February for Black History Month, and we did a civil rights leaders series of voices who are often not heard in our textbooks, in history books, and so forth. And so Mumia was one of those leaders that we examined. And basically, I put a quote up on the board, as they're due now. Due now is a quick activity, 5 to 10 minutes when you walk into the classroom. You know, you have a seat, open your notebook, and it's something to basically serve as your muse as you start the lesson. So the quote read, "So long as one just person is silenced, there is no justice." And that quote was by Mumia. And so after the students took some time to reflect, we discussed a little bit about Mumia, how he's a leader, you know, how he's a published author, and he's published books while being incarcerated. And we spoke a little bit about that. So a lot of my students were very intrigued by Mumia's story. So they went home and they did a lot of research on their own. They actually brought in the next day, they brought pictures and readings and like research that they had done at home, which was amazing to me. And so as we moved on to kind of engage in other civil rights leaders, students were still really interested in Mumia's case. And when he became sick in the month of April, I decided to share that information with them and to let them know that the hospital, you know, was not letting Mumia see his family. And so they were all very, very upset, outraged. You know, a lot of them commented that when they're sick, they want to see their family, they want to see their parents, and they want to be with family members. So they were very sympathetic and they were very compassionate towards Mumia's situation. So they asked to write letters, and this was in April, towards the beginning of the month of April, and they wrote the letters, and two of the students asked me if I would be able to deliver them, and I told them that was likely not going to happen, but, you know, I'll try. And when I spoke to Johanna, a professor at Baruch College, she said, "Oh, my God, these letters have to get to Mumia," and she delivered them for me, and that Tuesday they were in Mumia's hands.
And how old are your students?
They're about 8 years old.
When did you find out that you were in trouble?
I found out it was the Thursday of our spring break. So we were actually not in session. Initially, I found out just by seeing on Twitter that a lot of folks had been commenting and adding my Twitter feed and sending out tweets about my email, my work email, my principal's work email, and kind of just threatening to get me terminated. And so when I checked my phone, my principal had called me, and when I called her back, I told her I would like to meet with you in person with a union representative present. And then from there on, we had a meeting at the board on Monday, and then that following Tuesday night was the hearing. It was a public board meeting.
Now, these complaints against you, did you get any complaints directly from the parents of the students involved?
That's a great question. Not directly to me. So a lot of the parents that I've spoken to directly, all of the parents that I've spoken to directly, have been super supportive. And they've actually offered to lend a hand, and however they could help me in this situation, they're willing to do so. So parents have been super supportive. There has been parents in the district that have come out and spoken to media outlets and told them that they believe it was inappropriate, but it wasn't particularly any parents in my classroom.
The People's Organization for Progress and others rallied to your defense. They showed up at the board, and the board decided that you would remain suspended, but with pay. What does the future look like to you at your job in Orange?
That's a great question. I will not know officially until May 12th. That's the next public board meeting. So it's on May 12th at 7:30 in Orange Middle School, in Orange, New Jersey, and that's when they will make their final decision. Right now, I'm just looking forward to being in the classroom with my students again and finishing off the year right in a way in which my children can receive the education that they deserve. They've been in the classroom with a substitute teacher who doesn't know the curriculum, who doesn't necessarily have the resources to provide with the curriculum and the rest of the year of learning. So it's been really difficult for me to handle that and deal with that.
And what about other teachers at the school? Have they been supportive?
Yes. Fellow teacher of mine came out and spoke at the hearing as well. A lot of them have been told to not comment by the principal and by the school, and I respect teachers who choose to do that. I don't want them to necessarily put their job on the line. However, they have personally approached me and told me that they support me and that they believe that I'm a great teacher and that it was a huge misunderstanding.
Do you think the board has been under pressure from police unions and such?
I couldn't necessarily give any factual information on that, but I do believe that they're under pressure by the state indefinitely. I think that a lot of union reps from the District of Orange have expressed that to me directly and said that, you know, a union representative was supposed to speak on my behalf the night of the public hearing, and 30 minutes before I was going up to speak, they said that they could no longer do that.
You're speaking of the teachers' union.
I'm speaking of the teachers' union for my district, in which I'm a member and I pay my dues.
Which has fraternal relations with police unions, it must be noted.
Right.
You offered during that public hearing to turn in your resignation rather than face termination.
Yes.
Why'd you make that offer?
I made that offer because I knew that the district had every intent to terminate me that night at the public board meeting, and I decided to give my resignation to prevent any future issues that I might come into contact with as far as my career. So termination basically results in them being able to write the script and write whatever they feel I was terminated for. As opposed to me giving a resignation letter, I'm able to script that for myself and write exactly what happened and my story and my side of the situation that was going on.
And so this incident has not turned you off from a teaching career?
Absolutely not. I think that my passion is in teaching. My passion is in education. A lot of folks have asked me in the past, especially some of the folks who I organize with in the community, they have asked me, you know, how could you work for a system that's so flawed in so many ways? And the reason why I work for the public education system is not because I believe it's in the best state, but necessarily because it's so important for me to be with students who are in the public education system. And so I was in public schooling my entire life. And so I know what the public education system is like in our country, and I want to provide students with the opportunity to have an alternative education as opposed to the scripted curriculum that they're oftentimes faced with in the classroom. So I really do believe that we need more teachers who are socially conscious. We need more teachers who are willing to take risks in the classroom. We need more teachers who are there for the students, for the betterment of the students, and want to speak truth to our history and to our ancestors. I love my students, and they know this. And despite all of the controversy that's been going on in the community and supporters and non-supporters, I know that my students, at the end of the day, know how much I care for them. And I've had parents reaching out to me, and I've gotten the opportunity to speak to a few of my students over the phone, which has meant the world to me. It really has, and parents have been super supportive.
That was Marilyn Zuniga in Orange, New Jersey.
Ever since Cuba and the United States began the process of normalizing relations, folks have wondered what will happen to Asada Shakur, the former Black Panther who escaped from a U.S. prison and was given political asylum in Cuba 3 decades ago. U.S. visitors to Cuba got a definitive answer to that question from Ricardo Alarcón, a former foreign minister and president of the Cuban National Assembly. Alarcón told about 100 members of a Code Pink tour of the island that Cuba will always stand by Asada.
She was a victim of the repression against the Black Panther movement back in the 60s, 70s. She was the victim of a trial in which she was found guilty. Most of you, the first case in your history where a black person is victimized by courts and so on. I don't want to elaborate much more on that. One day, she managed to escape from the federal prison where she was. And she finally came down to Cuba and asked for asylum, and she was granted it. She's not a terrorist. She's not doing anything against any government. She has been living in Cuba for, my God, she's in the 70s or early 80s. And she is now really a victim and a target of the worst forces in the American society. They managed to have the FBI offering they're inviting Americans, now that we are getting, I hope, much more Americans coming down, where they try to get you as collaborators in taking this woman and in sending her back to prison in the US. It's a real threat on her life that is openly being promoted by some US politicians and the FBI. And you can be sure that ASATA will never be abandoned by us. That she deserves to get the attention of the American people to put an end to this policy of persecution or threatening of that woman. One state very active on this campaign against ASAPA is the state of New Jersey, because it was from New Jersey where the incident that was framed took place. You have a lot of people in New Jersey that deserve to be back there in jail. Beginning with the illustrious Senator Bob Menendez. It's a state that has plenty of criminals. Even at the highest offices in the Senate, is trying to persecute a poor woman that is doing harm to nobody and has the right to live in peace and security someday in her own country. But as long as she cannot do that, we will abide by our decision to grant her political asylum in this country that is also her country now. Thank you.
That was Cuban senior statesman Ricardo Alarcón speaking to a Code Pink delegation at the Havana headquarters of the Cuban Institute of Friendship with the Peoples.
Tania Serrano is president of the Institute and a member of the Cuban National Legislature. She responded to U.S. critics on race relations in Cuba.
First of all, the U.S. government has not any moral authority to criticize any other country in the world because of their racism. Because I know that, and you know that in the United States, the capitalist society, the imperialist society, is based on racism, discrimination, and the lack of equality. On the other hand, yes, in Cuba, thanks to the revolution, we have guaranteed equal access for everyone. We have guaranteed more equality and social justice for everyone. But still today, we have some cases of discrimination. And the revolution is powerful enough in order to overcome these expressions of discrimination that we still have. But of course, there are some plans coming from the U.S. A lot of money has been invested with some opinion leaders in the United States, and also agencies like the USAID agency that they are trying to present Cuba as a country where racism is everywhere. And that is not true. It is part of the old media campaign against Cuba. And our reaction will be, well, yes, we have problems in Cuba, but the problems in Cuba are solved by the Cuban people. We do not need any kind of mandatory person or institutions to come from outside to tell us what to do. Because if there is a process where we have conditions to solve all kinds of discrimination, it is the Cuban Socialist Revolution.
Cuba has one of the lowest internet participation levels in the world. Some people in the United States say the Cuban government is scared of the internet.
Yeah.
Anything to that?
Well, we have 25% of the Cuban people have access already to internet. And until the year 2020, we are committed with the Connection 2020. It is a plan in the United Nations. And I believe that the main obstacle for us to be fully connected, it is the U.S. blockade against Cuba. So if there is people in the United States that probably is sincerely concerned about our access to the internet, please tell that people that help us stopping the U.S. blockade against Cuba. And then that day we will have 100% access to internet for everyone. In between, we continue developing our access to internet, to the new technologies, with our own resources. And I could tell you that it is not going to be the market, the one deciding who is going to be connected in Cuba. It is going to be the social policies that we establish in Cuba in order to allow people to really achieve new knowledge and to have more capability dealing with the new world where we are living.
That was Tania Serrano of the Cuban Institute of Friendship with the Peoples.
Joseph Kabila, the president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, is constitutionally barred from running for re-election in 2016. But opposition parties fear he'll try to find a way to stay in power. Meanwhile, according to Kambale Musavuli of the Washington-based Friends of Congo, the United States has been funding Congolese youth groups in an attempt to manipulate the politics of the country.
There are real vibrant youth movements on the ground on the African continent. Little by little, they're being co-opted, mainly because USAID has money. And then the question to be asked is, one, who is doing political education? Who is supporting youth movement who are actually creating change? I will have discussion with some of these youths that say, hey, you have to be very careful how you engage. And the usual response is, well, they're paying for the flight. Are you going to pay for the flight? They're paying for this event. Are you going to pay for this event? And if we're not providing alternative and also learning from history, you know, how Compare Pro worked, to know what Compare Pro is today on the African continent.
Well, the United States is anticipating that President Kabila will not be on the scene for much longer, although he is resisting leaving after his term expires.
Yes, the United States has been very clear to the regime of Kabila. They do not want him to stay. They do not want him to change the constitution. And they have the interest. At this time, we've seen some shape or form that the will of the Congolese people is colliding in the same direction with what U.S. interest is. But the challenge that I have with the U.S. government is that their interest is around, one, corporate interests, and two, people that they would like to have to serve U.S. interests. At this time, I can't clearly say who the U.S. is picking as the next leader of the Congo. I can only speculate. But my biggest concern right now has been U.S. funding youth movement on the African continent, specifically funding youth movement in the Congo. We have seen it in Latin America. We have seen how that has affected, in the case of Venezuela, the so-called pro-democracy movements, who may sometime prop up legitimate claims from the people, but yet are being influenced by the U.S., and that's what we do not want. You know, we want the African affairs to be controlled by Africans. We want Congolese to control their own affairs. We can continue to be babysit by the West, where they come and interfere with our political affairs. We don't see the Congolese government funding youth movement in Ferguson. Why should USAID fund youth movement in the Congo or on the African continent?
In general, are the youth in Congo sophisticated enough to know that the people who give them money for their organizations are not necessarily friends of their country?
Unfortunately, you know, we have a huge gap in terms of educating not just the Congo, but the world on how the U.S. operates in terms of soft power. We know in the 80s, the creation of USAID and why it was created and what it's actually doing now. It appears very benign. One, they will fund very basic events such as cultural events, or in West Africa, right now, speaking about the Ebola crisis, we see the engagement around having support to the doctors and so on. But then the support starts moving little by little, where you start seeing in meetings with USAID, you have the Pentagon sitting in a meeting. You start asking yourself, why do we have the U.S. military in these meetings? And they say, well, they're providing logistical support, right? So we start seeing how little by little doors are being opened for U.S. military interests on the African continent. Now, in the case of the Congo, as you ask, unfortunately, many youths are not sophisticated enough to know. It's attributed to a few things, right? One, Congo is a French-speaking country, and our engagement with Anglo-Saxons, specifically London and Washington, has been in a way where they've propped up dictators, right? And then on the other hand, they come and look almost as people who are helping. So the second challenge is the age of the population. You know, half of the Congolese population is over the age of 18. And when you think about that, and you start thinking about when the war in the Congo started in 1996, most of the youth today were very young when the war started in the Congo, and may not have the opportunity to understand the geopolitics around U.S. support of youth movement there. And this is an alert not just for the listeners or the readers, but it's an alert to the world. Where is the left in the analysis of what's happening in the Congo right now? Where is the left in the analysis of what's happening on the African continent? We have a vibrant youth movement ready for change. Some of them are being co-opted, but others are still legitimate. Why don't we see those interactions that we've had back in the 60s, where we had Malcolm X educating people in Harlem about, if you understand what's happening in Mississippi and Alabama, you can understand what's happening in the Congo. Can we say, if you understand what's happening in Baltimore and Ferguson, you can understand what's happening in the Congo today? That's what's missing right now, political analysis and understanding that people of color around the world are being under attack through militarism and mainly U.S. interests as U.S. corporate interests around the world.
Is it the case that young folks in the Congo may believe that because the United States would prefer that President Kabila, who they oppose, leave at the end of his term, that the United States is a friend of change, positive change in the Congo, self-determination for the Congo?
I mean, I have to say, those who are supported by the U.S. are a very, very small minority. They do not even have a following. You know, it's quite interesting to have read the media and see what is happening and the names of the so-called youth leaders who are being propped up. They don't have a following inside of the country. The population may not be easily manipulated. The challenge is in these scenarios, let's make a comparison with Contempo. When we think about how the Black Panthers was infiltrated, you had people who were very vocal or very disturbing in the movement who were FBI agents who may not have any following. But because of resources that they had, their presence and their actions were magnified. That's what we're seeing there now in the Congo. While we have youth movements who are engaging for change, the U.S. have handpicked a selected few of not more than a dozen who are receiving funding, who are being provided access, media access, and so on. And then when the world is hearing about youth movement in the Congo, they are getting excited. So they are actually misleading the entire world, not the local population. The local population right now is fighting for a few things, but the main one is they do not want President Kabila to run in 2016. They do not want him to change the constitution, and they are tired of the situation. So what the U.S. is doing, knowing that the will of the people is calling for change, and it's an inevitable change, they want to make sure that they are at the end of this Congolese revolution that we call the Telema uprising, that they are still connected with youth or Congolese who may be at the table, at the decision-making table, so that U.S. interest is protected. So that's what the U.S. is doing, but that will still be hard for them to be able to control the whole population. And that's why we want to sound the alert. We ought to sound the alarm and letting the world know to be worried about what is happening on the African continent right now. And for those who love peace, who want stability, who want to see change on the continent, to be of support to young African youth working for change.
The youth are paying a high price in their effort to keep Kabila from extending his term in power.
Indeed. You know, 100 have been in prison, or over 400 of them since March are still in prison. Do not know the charges that they have against them. A few others were arrested on March 15th after a press conference. There are those who have been killed. The official government count for the uprising in January of 2015 is that only 12 people died. Human Rights Watch has said that 42 people have died. And about a week or so ago, we found a mass grave with 400 bodies in it, 425 dead bodies in it. So guess what the Congolese government is saying? That these dead bodies are people that have died, were in the morgue in hospital in Kinshasa, and dead fetuses. So they think that the whole population and the entire world is going to believe that fetuses and dead bodies in the morgue are among the 400 dead bodies there, and that these bodies had nothing to do with the protesters who were killed. And why am I making this bold statement that I do believe that these dead bodies are those who were killed? Is that during the protest in January, the Congolese military went to hospitals and they were actually stealing dead bodies. Not just because I'm saying that it's been documented by our Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and other respectable organizations, that dead bodies were being stolen by the Congolese military. So we still don't know where these bodies are. And all of a sudden, we found the 400 dead bodies in a mass grave. So seeing that, I'm clear that the fight for change in the Congo is happening right now. So many people are not aware of that. And the youth of the Congo is paying the high price. What I do hope that the world will do, just as we see with other youth movements around the world, when Congolese rise, we hope that people will relay the message around the world and they will come to support the action. Because the moment the people on the ground know that people outside of the country are supporting them, it gives them strength to keep fighting because they feel that they are not alone. And that's the call that Patrice Lumumba gave in 1960. Now, when he presciently said, "We are not alone. Africa, Asia, and free and liberated people from around the globe will always be at the side of the Congolese." And that's what we hope people will do at this present time as the Congolese people are rising up, as they say in Lingala, Telema.
Is the organized movement against Kabila confined largely to the capital, Kinshasa, or spread around the country?
It has spread around the country, and it needs to be actually not just framed around Kabila. It needs to be framed around the Congolese people who are tired of the system. This is really why they went out. When you speak to some of the youths who participated in the protests in January, they say, "We didn't go out just because we didn't want the government to change the constitution. So we went out because we're tired of seeing the Congolese police harass our mothers who may be selling a few goods in the market. We are tired of not having adequate education, electricity, food, the basic needs of the country. We are tired of that after over 16 years. We still have a war in the country that's not ending. We are tired of seeing politicians stealing from the state coffers." So all that sentiment manifested the action of the Congolese parliament to even try to introduce a law that will extend Kabila's term in a de facto way was just one element among many that has pushed the people to go out. Not just in Kinshasa, the capital city, but in many other cities, like Goma and Lubumbashi and other cities. And for the next 2 years, we are clear that more and more people are going to come out and demand change, but the challenge that they're facing a brutal regime who have guns. And we have to be clear that our military in the Congo is armed, trained by the U.S. military. We provide military support to the Kabila regime. Could go to the U.S. Embassy in Kinshasa and look at the November 2011 press release, where they say in their own press release that they provided $500,000 worth of police gear to the Congolese police to maintain peace and stability during the elections in 2011. So guess what happened in December of 2011? That same police that received the gear from the American government shot at his own civilians and killed scores, which was even filmed by Al Jazeera and other international media.
Is it widely understood among Congolese youth that the United States is the power behind the regime?
It is not that clear. It needs more sophistication to understand that, because the role of the U.S. in Congo has been quite interesting, right? On one hand, the conflict and the war that we've had in the East, we've had Rwanda and Uganda, who are U.S. allies on the war on terror, who have destabilized the Congo. Since 1996, he invaded it twice and has unleashed the deaths of millions of Congolese up until today. Then you have the Kabila regime in the Congo, which is also supported by the United States. So you can see that the United States supports both sides at the end of whichever side. And now we see with their so-called pro-democracy program, they're supporting some new figures in the Congo. So they want to make sure no matter what takes place in the Congo, they are still in control of the Congo. And why the Congo? The Congo is a strategic country on the African continent. It has every known minerals in the world. Whoever controls the Congo controls the world. That's what Mao was saying. So the U.S. wants to make sure that they are still controlling. But not everyone within the country is understanding why they are catching hell every day. So that's why we need those political analysis, which we can share back with the youth to know, one, history, how history is repeating itself, and two, what other countries where become somewhat self-sustainable and independent have done to prevent U.S. interests to affect the interests of their own people.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.